Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our docket for oral submission this afternoon and multiple cases that are going to be submitted without oral argument. So we have, I believe, Mr. Dirksen and Ms. Jester. Are you all ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Our clerk will call the case and we'll get started.
The court will now call Alex L. Comodano, trustee of Kendrick Family Trust versus Jesse D. Holman, Jr. May it please the court, Mr. Tom Dirksen will argue for the appellant. Ms. Jill Jester will argue for the appellee.
Absolutely.
I understand that I have 15 minutes. The court will be glad I'll be very brief, as I'm not sure my voice is going to make it. May it please the court, Tom Dirksen for appellant. We're here today in consideration of an appeal filed on the second final decree of partition coming out of the 367th Judicial District Court. Primarily, we argue that the partition decree is deficient in the property decree set forth therein. Specifically, it purports to give Lot 2A, Block 1 of Holman Edition, which is recorded in Cabinet G and Plaque, page 8. If we stop there, we're good to go. We don't. Because there's a reservation in the grant saying except that portion of Lot 2A, which consists of approximately 0.609 acres, which is then described on the Exhibit A there too as 0.609 acres by cross-hatching. As the court is, I'm sure, already familiar, the cross-hatching is done on a document that's coming out of the Denton County Technology Services. I'm assuming this is the Denton CAD Central Appraisal District. And while it's a good outfit, the case law suggests that we don't use appraisal district maps or descriptions to describe property. Therefore, the property description set forth in the deed, which should ring out like a fireball in the night, has a good and sufficient description of the property. As a warranty deed, under 2304 of the property code and also 12.05 of the property code, which makes such judgment essentially akin to a special warranty deed. Now, this property was acquired by the appellee's parent some 60 years ago. 30 years ago, we plat the property. And if we stop and use that plat, probably get a lot closer to being sufficient, because the plat would be essentially whole in and of itself if they drew a starting and stopping point.
So you're not really complaining that reserved out of that lot was a 0.607 acres of land. You're just saying that it needs to be sufficiently described. But you're not complaining at all about the fact that there was 0.607
no, I believe
acres carved out.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the commissioners got that right.
Okay.
I believe their accounting process, my client has a little problem. I don't legally find a problem with it. I find that the numbers and the work was correct. What I do find is the specificity required by 769 is not there, sufficient to put us on notice. To quote my hero, paraphrasing, the partition shouldn't be the end of the beginning. It shouldn't be the beginning of the end. It needs to be the end of the end. We need to be done. Two-step process. This second final decree should have been the denouement, should have been the end of the story. And we just don't feel that it gets there. There are some other problematic elements in the judgment of the court. We feel that the partition process, because this is essentially tantamount to lie is its divorce, real property is its partition. We understand. We came on late. Tempers were, of course, high. But we don't feel that the award of costs solely to the plaintiff, I'm sorry, the appellant in this instance, was correct. We don't feel that it was supported by any evidence or the procedure. So we feel that that should be struck. And that the grant of taxes is also insufficient, as it was only supported by a statement. The witness failed to tie it to the properties at large and give sufficient offset, which was provided by my client. My client testified at trial, and it's presumed that owners should know the bounty, that she did not know where the property stopped and ended under this grant. With that, I rest, Your Honor.
Mr. Derrickson?
Yes, sir.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
What's your position on what should have been the handling of cost in the case? How many dollars should have been taxed according to the statute you cite in order for it to be a proportional award of cost?
I think that I'll have to look at the decree, but it roughly should have been 50-50. We try to get away from, in the partition, attorney's fees and costs and make it as equitable as possible. The parties should each bear one half of the cost. I also go to the award, and I'm assuming that some part of the cost, and it was not handled properly. The commissioners themselves are to attach to the commissioner's report their costs, and then the costs are to be considered by the court and awarded based upon proportion to the parties. That wasn't it. We got all of that piece. As my client testified, she already paid directly, not pursuant to the rules, one of the commissioners, the one who actually testified, Ms. Solinger. So there should have been an offset for those costs, and the cost should also be allocated essentially one half, diminished by a slightly larger proportion.
All right, then do I take it you have no quarrel with, you don't seem to have it in the point of error, the dollar amount that is provided in the commissioner's report as to the amount awarded to the parties, $138,675 to Mr. Holman and the Tally Donald Tract and Trust, $116,325.
I don't think that the costs were properly presented or that there's any evidence of what...
I'm excluding costs. Now, I understand right. You don't like the costs and you want those handled 50-50.
Correct.
But you're not attacking, if I'm understanding and reading your brief, the dollar evaluations that the commissioners put in the second report as to the way they had apportioned the...
No, Your Honor, I'm not. I think they've got the numbers right.
All right. Then, secondly, was there evidence at trial tied the lot numbers, which I take it are on plats, filed as a part of the city?
Yes, Your Honor. At GPJ.
And then these references here on this document, I'm not going to call it anything but a document, don't relate to the lot and block numbers.
No, Your Honor.
This language over here on the right-hand side, right about bottom corner of the Exhibit A, it concerns me because it's more than a disclaimer. It's almost a don't use this for anything statement. It's saying is that it's not prepared or suitable for legal or engineering or surveying purposes and doesn't represent an on-the-ground survey, represents only an approximate relative location of property boundaries.
Correct. Absolutely. You're here.
Well, my question of you is, would a survey... Can a surveyor, from your work in this case, what we're usually looking for from a legal standpoint is enough of a description of property in a conveyance or in other documents that relate to title to property. We're looking for enough of a description so that a surveyor could go on the land and find the boundaries.
With this document, no, we can't.
Okay, well, that's the ruling. You gave us a copy of one case. And I know that to be an accurate statement of the law in terms of what's an adequate property description. And I'm asking you, is it your position that a surveyor could start with the document, the records that are in the deed records, in the county deed records, and this document, and make an accurate survey of the property that separates out, according to the proximity on this Exhibit A, the 6.09 acres?
I would answer your question in the affirmative. I think a good surveyor can create a survey, but it would be his survey, and it would be an approximation. It would not be the property as described by the commissioners appointed, because it would not have been in their direction. He would be fashioning something out of whole cloth. I think any surveyor could do that. And he could probably, looking at it and try to render, I think he could. But it would not be the survey as directed by the commissioners.
Obviously, you can't go back and, well, you might could go back and reopen, have the commissioners come back in, look again, do some other things.
Well, that's what we ask.
It comes out of this court.
That's what we ask for. There's no provision in the rules to reconsider. It's reject or accept. Now, we considered a trial going to court, and appellees didn't join me. I think they wanted to be done, but didn't join in that. I would like to send it back. We're looking at they amended their report, should have amended the report to include that boundary line.
You'd like to have seen the third report.
With a meets and bounds. And they could have gotten there. A boundary line survey, which is all that's required, going to that plat, they could pull out the property lines rather quickly of north, south, and east, and then just add that boundary, run that tangent.
And
I don't think it'd be $200.
Concerned about looking at the map. Now, does this map accurately depict north-south? It's got a north-south marker on the bottom of the Exhibit A. Is that accurate, that part of it?
And using my recollection and going back to the plat, it does.
And so the boundary that you're concerned about is the boundary that's the southernmost boundary as it meanders from west to east, east to west.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
It makes a sharp turn, that boundary line. Is there a fence there or some structure or something?
There was an abandoned road that in the first part of the procedure, essentially all of the improvements were awarded to the appellant, defendant.
So that line that goes across, up, and across again is an old road?
It appears to me to have been based, especially the more westerly portion, sorry, easterly portion, southeasterly portion, appears to track where the old abandoned road would have been. And especially problematic for my client, and probably for appellee too, is where will these lines go in going through the pecan trees that are of some value to both parties?
Oh, there's a pecan orchard right in the dead center of
it. Yes.
Okay.
Which is why we're here.
Okay.
Outside of all cost. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I be seated?
Yes, sir. Bester.
May it please the court. My name is Jill Jester, and I, along with my co-counsel Sarah Hoffman, are here today representing Jesse Holman, the appellee, in this matter. In my time before the court today, we will discuss three issues. First, the sufficiency of the property description in the commissioner's report. Second, the apportionment of cost of suit, and third, the allocation of taxes, and while the trial court's judgment should be affirmed. The first issue, the property identified in the commissioner's report was intelligible as required by the Texas Rule of Civil Procedures. First, a survey is not required for a property description to be intelligible. The commissioner's report standard is stated, as the appellant stated, in Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 769. And in that rule, it states the commissioner shall report in writing and under oath to the court a report that describes the property that is to be divided, describing the same, and the report shall be accompanied by such field notes, maps, as may be necessary to make the same intelligible. In our case, we had attached to both the Exhibit A that you have in front of you, that map was attached to first the commissioner's report, and second, the final order of decree in the partition suit. You can see the area that is carved out of where we already have three boundary lines that have been pre-platted. And it's that fourth line down at the bottom is the only one left to determine, and that is indicated by the crosshatched. You can also see on the color map you have in front of you, that was plaintiff's exhibit number 6. You can see that in volume 3 of the reporter's record, that it follows a driveway and a house. And we'll get to more evidence about why it's there later. I'd like to note that the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure specifically say a survey is not required in order for the property description to be intelligible. Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 764 says the court, should it deem it necessary, appoint a surveyor to assist the commissioners in making the partition. Again, it does not require meets and bounds for it to meet the standard. Second, the order approving the commissioner's report met the standard of property description in a deed. Indeed, all of appellant's cases cited in their brief are specific to what is sufficient for a deed and not the commissioner's report, which is what the appellant argued in his brief. In this Texas Supreme Court case, Texas Builders v. Keller, located at 928 Southwest 2nd, 479 in 1996, the court held specifically stated that a meets and bounds description is not required to be enforceable. Just to furnish the data within itself or by referencing some other existing document or existing writing to identify the property with reasonable certainty. That is our test for the deed. Is it reasonably certain to identify that piece of property? We, in Ardmore Incorporated versus Rex Group Incorporated, located at 377 Southwest 3rd 45, a 2012 case out of Houston that was not in our brief, but we would be happy to provide it in a supplemental brief if the court so chooses. This case was about a lease agreement with a right to purchase. And the court said specifically they were applying the same standard to the legal description as they would a deed. In that case, there were three boundary lines already set, already fixed. And the fourth line was identified on a map running through a parking lot. The court confirmed the description in this document despite its own note saying the location of the line was not identified with exact precision. It said it could be reasonably certain to identify it, and indeed, so long as the identification in general areas of the land contains information such as size, shape, and boundaries, that this was something a surveyor could later find and fix exactly. There is a case out there that has facts similar to ours as far as a property description, and that was also attached to our brief which we submitted to the court. In McDonald versus Dennison at 199 Southwest 2nd 707 out of Austin, it was a suit for specific performance in a contract to convey land. And per the court, the same rule was applicable to a description in a deed that they applied in this case. Again, the test in this case was whether the description given with the aid of extrinsic evidence is sufficient to locate the premises on the ground either by field notes given, if any, or reference to other established and ascertainable boundaries. This is similar to ours in that the McDonald case was dealing with a large tract of land in which a smaller portion was being carved out. Also in this case, we had three of the four boundaries already set, as we did in this case. None of the cases cited in McDonald required meets and bounds. And in such cases as McDonald, the descriptions were held to be sufficient that designated the acreage and located it on one side or out of one corner whose boundaries are established without prescribing either the length or course of the inside line of the tracts to be conveyed. In this court, when the McDonald court went on further to say the inside line of the new piece of property can be later fixed and made certain by a surveyor. In the case at hand, the acreage to be conveyed was stated in the final decree as well as in the commissioner's report as 0.609 acres from lot 2A. The commissioner's report as well, that was also incorporated into the final decree, did have a lot and block describing for you the three out of the four borders, telling you how many acreage was to come out, and then attaching a map showing you that it goes along the house and the driveway to make it ascertainable. Three, should the property description not meet the standards of a commissioner's report or a deed in a partition suit, the law allows us to look at the entire proceedings to identify the property. In Finley versus Ogletree, which can be found at 277 Southwest 2nd, 135, it's a case out of Beaumont, and this is, I think, the only other case that is not in our brief, but we would be happy to supply in a supplemental brief. It was a trespass to try title suit, and in establishing the passage of title, the plaintiff relied upon a partition of the estate by a probate court. The court in that case said, standing alone, the description by which the land was awarded to the plaintiff in the partition decree might not be legally sufficient in a deed of conveyance to convey the land. Indeed, in that case, the description made no reference to what state, county, or any survey in which the land was situated. But, that court said, the partition proceedings and the decree of partition must be construed together and as a whole, and when so construed, the property description was sufficient. And I think this is because a deed doesn't have a docket sheet. An order is surrounded by the proceedings and should be construed as a whole. And the finding in Finley versus Ogletree promotes much needed judicial efficiency and economy by not requiring a complete new trial, new money and time expended by all parties, attorneys, and the judge when the information has already been provided for the property's description. Because the identification of the property in the commissioner's report was intelligible and evidence showed it was adequate to allow a survey to be conducted, the trial court was correct to approve the commissioner's report. Second.
Ms. Jester?
Yes, sir.
Is it your position that there are historical documents that help locate the boundaries of the 0.609 acres? All of the boundaries?
I'm not sure as far as historical, but I believe that the color map in front of you show where the line indicate, that fourth line would be indicated, as well as the map that has the cross hatch section.
What I'm asking you is,
yes,
that there is reference in the briefs, the two briefs, talks about other documents on file in county records, deed records, and city records dealing with lot and blocks and dealing with the parcels of land and dealing with descriptions of the land. But as I read both briefs, there is not any indication that there is anywhere a place to go look at and figure out where the boundaries would be of the 6.09 acres other than this report.
That's right, sir. Yes, sir.
All right. Are you satisfied that your client today could go out and build a fence on the line and know where to put the fence if he's trying to build a fence marking off the boundaries of the 6.09 acres?
Yes, sir, I do.
What do you base that on?
I base that on the fact that the crosshatch section that is carved out of where we already have the three boundaries, we're only needing the fourth line.
Well, it's really three lines. It's not a fourth line. It's that fourth line is a line across, a line down or up, depending on the direction you're going, and then another line. So it's three lines. And that's what, I mean, what is along that, what I will call a jagged line, okay? What's along there that I could go out there and say, ah, that's the line right there. I can see it with my own eyes.
There's a driveway and a house.
Okay, so there's a driveway that takes a 90-degree turn and then another 90-degree turn?
I believe if you look at the color,
I didn't get that.
That the driveway is a bit diagonal as it goes up, and then you can see that what the commissioners did is draw the line continuing, you're right, it has more lines, that goes up to go around the house that has been awarded solely to the appellant and continues across to the extending existing boundary.
How far do we know, how do we know how far that line that goes around the house is from the house? Is it 500 feet? Is it 1,000 feet? How do we know?
I believe that we can know approximately. However, we do believe, and we have been attempting to get a surveyor on the property to get the exact measurements.
Okay. And when it goes around the house, is there a, does it meet up with another well-known line?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. So it follows a driveway, and then at some point, we don't know how far from the house it goes north. And then at some point, we don't know how far it goes west again.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
What's this little, there's the what appears to be a footprint of a house, a driveway, some other parts, are there on this color picture that's marked Exhibit 6? What is the little square thing? Is that a barn that's over on what would be the westernmost line of this track?
I have not seen it with my own eyes, but I understand there are possibly storage sheds or I don't believe there's any other habitable building. I think there were places for yard work
this
equipment, et cetera.
Picture, and I'm just saying that the picture does show some kind of a least rectangular structure.
Your Honor, I do not know what the structure is.
Right. Thank you for answering my questions. I know you had some other points.
Shall I continue? Second, the trial court correctly applied Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 141 and did not abuse its discretion by appropriating costs to the applicant. Because of the plain language and legislative intent of Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 141 is clear, and because the priority of the judiciary is to do justice, the trial court did not abuse their discretion in apportioning the cost in this matter to appellant. First, the plain language of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure supports the trial court's discretion. In a regular partition suit, the court divides the cost in proportion to the shares allocated or the value of said shares. And that, as the appellant quoted, is in Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 778. However, in this matter, the judge awarded the costs under 141, Texas Rule of Civil Procedure, which she cited in her findings of fact and conclusions of law on page 3. That rule says, for good cause, the courts may divide the costs otherwise than as provided by law or these rules. And as I'm sure you know, Rule 1 of the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure says, the objective of these rules is to obtain a just, fair, equitable, an impartial adjudication, and these rules shall be given a liberal construction.
What was the good cause?
The good cause was some of the specifics that were cited would be avoiding service to where the appellee could see the appellant in her house refusing to answer the door after numerous process server attempts to serve. We eventually had to file and received permission to for alternative service. No shows at hearings. Then my client The appellee had to pay for a process server to then find her and serve her to order her at the next hearing. More than a mediation was canceled at least once was because the attorney for her at the time, I don't believe it's Mr. Dickerson, could not find her to speak with her and make sure she was going to show up. There were many more. This case has been over 5 years. My client has incurred over $30,000 in attorney's fees. He's in his 80s. The point was to clear all the title up for his children, and unfortunately, we're still not there. And so the judge who sat in the chair and heard all of the testimony firsthand, who saw each exhibit, who saw each pleading, determined that the cost of $2,000 and a bit more, sorry, $2,021.50 was fair and just to be allocated to the appellant because of her obstructionism. And I believe that that is the reason we have this rule, because there is a line between being reasonable and being sanctionable. And one of the goals of my client was to wrap up his estate before he passes. And so as opposed to filing a new motion and incurring new costs and delaying, we were grateful that the judge considered Rule 141 when we argued costs. And I believe that is my time, unless there are... I'd be happy to talk. All right. For these reasons, appellees ask the court to affirm the third 367th Denton County judgment on the issues of sufficiency of property description, allocations of costs and suit, and award of ad valorem taxes. Thank you.
Mr. Dirksen, would you please add a couple of minutes of time to Mr. Dirksen as we head over with Ms. Jester? Thank you.
My rebuttal will be quick. As to cause, again, I don't believe there was sufficient evidence. I don't believe there was any evidence of good cause to sanction my client. The record is devoid, first part, second part, of any motions to compel or for sanctions. My client is sometimes difficult to find for me. It's not our fault. And I don't believe it. The testimony rises to the level of cause to award what is tantamount to sanctions. Again, citing 141, we also look for analogy to 250, were there lesser means tried in the interim? No, there weren't. Secondarily, the cases cited for sufficiency were on sale of property where essentially it was one tract only, not where the description would constitute the boundary between the properties. And we've hit on the real point is, where do you put the line? Can you build a fence there? And I don't know where to put it. Thank you.
Mr. Dirksen, Ms. Jester, thank you so much for your arguments here today and for your briefing as well. Your case is submitted, and we will be adjourned.